If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. In my opinion, my next guest is one of the coolest guys and one of the best musicians to ever be in Christian music. I'm excited to have Rick Kua on the podcast today. We'll get to his story in just a moment, but I want to remind you to consider becoming a premium subscriber. That way, you get early access to all episodes. You get some in-depth information into who's coming up next and some great video content, and you can sign up. It's real easy. Just go to my website, andychristman.com, and while you're there, sign up for my newsletter as well. That way, you get all the information on the podcast, my radio show, Worship with Andy Christman, and just all the really cool things that God has me doing for worship leaders and churches around the world. Again, that's at andychristman.com. Okay, here's my conversation with the legendary Rick Kua. So I was in a band, but not really. I mean, I was in a group of guys that sang up front. We were, I guess, For Him was, could you call us kind of the first boy band or man band of Christian music back in the early 90s. But I wouldn't put us in the category of real bands. And Rick, that's where I'm just in awe of what you accomplished in your career and the skill set that God gave you. Just listening to your music in the 80s and early 90s and just seeing that what we did was great. What you guys did was cool. I wanted your hair. You know,
I want it back.
Yeah, I want to. I don't want to make you miss it or anything.
No,
but,
no.
Man, I wanted your hair. I wanted that. You were such a great front man. You know, you had that vibe that I think all of us were kind of looking for and longing for if we were trying to become, you know, I don't want to say a rock star because that's not what we were.
Right.
But that was so cool because, you know, we were emulating all of us. We all emulate who we've seen and grown up with. And Rick, I always wanted to be you.
Wow.
But I knew I was never going to have that skill set. And so I'm just excited to be able to spend a little time with you, hear your story, just say thank you, if anything, for, you know, the deposit that you didn't even know you were making into my life. Mm. And I'm just glad you're here on the One Degree of Andy podcast. Well, Rick Kua, thank you, man.
Thank you, Andy. And thank you for those kind words. And you have to know, for myself and many that did what I did, we look at all of us as doing it the same, and we would look at you as, man, For Him's playing tonight. I mean, seriously, because the gifting and the creativity that goes into whether you're up there with a band or you're playing with tracks or you've got studio musicians, doesn't matter. You guys communicated the story of Christ in such a way that people could not wait. And your singles were great and all of that. So
wow, thank you.
Again, kind of you, but I will turn that back around to you as well.
Well, I appreciate that. We all watched each other. And I think that was the beauty of, especially in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, which I say on the podcast all the time, I feel like that was the golden era of Christian music.
Yeah.
Like probably 80, maybe 83 to... whenever the Imperials, whenever Michael Amardian got a hold of the Imperials, and that really started to change what Christian music could sound like all the way into the early 2000s before worship kind of took over, you know, the genre. But we all did watch each other and we gleaned from each other. And I think because, you know, again, 90s radio was the Wild West. I mean, you have a Rick Kua song, then you have a For Him song, you have Twyla Paris, and you'd have Steve Taylor, and then you would have, you know, you'd have Petra and Whiteheart, and then Sandy Patty and Carmen, and you know, and it was, but we all watched each other
Yeah. And we're able to go, what they're doing is really cool. I wonder if we could do something like that.
Yeah.
Or the way that you would present the gospel and the way we would present the gospel, we'd watch each other and go, well, that's effective. That's really cool. Mm. Or, what producer are they using? What, what mix engineer are they using? Because that record sounds really good.
Yeah. And we were all that way. We were not competing. I really feel in my heart, we were brothers just doing what we did.
Yeah.
And, maybe I'd do something that, you liked and looked at, and then you would do something and your single would go to number one. And I'm thinking, okay, a little more inspirational for us or whatever it was. We gleaned off of each other, and that was the beautiful thing. And here we are in this day, decades later, still excited about what we did and the impact truly that music still has on the audience that listened the first time.
I agree. And so many people are going back and discovering it again.
Yeah.
Which is I think is really cool because it was really good. And I don't know if you were like this, we all have our transitions out of our heyday.
Yes.
In the music industry. And we'll get to that in a little bit. I don't want to go too far down the road with that yet, but and I've said this many times in the podcast, I tried to maybe close the door on that part of my career for a long time while I went and did other things and, didn't necessarily want to be reminded of that part of my life because I was like, it's over now.
Yeah.
And it had its arc of popularity.
Yeah.
And I don't want to live in the past. I want to move on to do whatever God has for me next. For me, it was worship and radio and doing some other things. But, I wondered, did you do kind of the same thing? Did once you felt like that was over, part of your life was over, you're kind of like, I want to move on and not have that be my calling card anymore?
For me, Andy, what it really was is there was a point where I needed to shift my passion. And I figured, listen, I'm a musician, and I would tell my young friends this all the time. You will never stop being a musician, a singer, a songwriter, an artist, somebody that presents the gospel through music. That is in you. But there's a point where you can't pay your mortgage anymore. I'm just going to be realistic and say, now I've got to shift my passion.
Right.
And I would have people come to me. When I went to work at the only, I would call it day job I had ever in my life was about 5.5 years at EMI Christian Music Publishing. And when I took that job, and I was so grateful for it, and I loved it. But when I took that job, I would have a lot of young and my age musicians that were, as the industry would say, and not in a bad way, but we were past peak, right? And I would have them come to me like, how did you do it? How did you make this transition? And I would just love on them, encourage them, coach them, and say, you just have to know that you are not ever going to stop being that musician or writer or singer that God has put in you.
Yeah.
You have to shift some of that passion to something to take care of your family. And not only that, the hope is you can learn to love that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's working and you're excited about it and you're not a one trick pony, so to speak. And again, I don't mean that in a derogatory way.
Yeah.
We can do more than just write, sing, and play. As much as we love it, there are other things we can do.
Yeah.
And so I did that for 5.5 years, and I loved it, met a lot of great people, learned a little bit more about the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we all need to do. It's not that I've never looked down at the stuff I did at all. Even when things started to go down, the gigs didn't come in as much, radio was not as interested as they were before. Even at that, I thought, I signed up for this.
Yeah.
Whatever it's going to be, is it's going to be.
Yeah.
I'm fine. Even if I got a review from somebody that maybe, fortunately, there weren't a lot of unfavorable ones, but maybe somebody said something that triggered me a little and got my ire up a little, I would always remember, wait, I said yes to all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody's got an opinion.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot in those days. And fortunately, I still do a certain amount along with the stuff that I do at the church on a regular basis. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get back to that in a minute. I want to go rewind all the way back. So let's talk about how you got into this business. And like, you know, again, I love to ask this question. What was your aha moment where you went, oh, maybe I'm good at this. Maybe I can make a living at this.
Yeah, here's what I think. I came from secular music. So I grew up in Syracuse, New York, always in bands. My father was a musician and he was very encouraging to me. And I had, you know, I had some really good bands up there. We were busy. We worked most every night of the week. We enjoyed it. And then I wound up joining a secular group called the Outlaws.
Mm-hmm.
They were under Arista, Clive Davis's label at the time. And so I was already, I had learned to, I'll just say, capture somebody's attention.
Yeah.
Or entertain, which really is capturing somebody's attention for a purpose, right? Yeah. So I already did that. And then there was a point where there was two things for me. One is I got saved in 1977. My wife, Diana, got saved 5 years before me in 72. And one night she came home after going to a Phil Keaggy concert with some of her girlfriends from the church. I was listening to probably the new Nightfly record by Donald Fagen,
yeah.
And I was more into what I would call more sophisticated kind of music.
Yeah.
Just my words for it.
And were you still in the Outlaws at that time?
No, or? I was in Syracuse. This was in the 70s and probably when late 77, 8, 9, around there.
Uh-huh.
And so I got my band, I'm playing, and Diana said to me, will you take a minute and listen to this record? And being a guy that wanted to make my wife happy, I learned to want to make her happy much more at this age. But now, you know, I said, sure. And she put on Phil Keaggy. And I listened and I thought, wow, this is real music.
Yeah.
Meaning it was the kind of music I loved.
Yeah.
You know, so the Keaggy thing was pretty great. And then not long after that, I ran into an old buddy of mine, Joe English.
Oh, yeah.
I'm from Syracuse. He grew up in Rochester, New York. We had bands that we played on the same stages together with our bands, our secular bands. And he told me about this record that he had that he wanted to send to me. And it was his first Christian record. It was on Refuge Records. And I said, yeah, great, send it. So 2 weeks later in the mail, that's how long it takes to mail back then. You know, and I got the record. Yeah. And I put it on, and it was the same thing. I thought, wow, listen to these players. Listen to the songs. They hit a nerve within me. And so I wrote Joe back, yes, a letter with a stamp on it. And I said, Joe, this is awesome. I love it. Thanks for sending. Because he had told me he had gotten saved, and I told him I did as well. And then he came back to me again, and he said, I want to introduce you to my manager, Ray Nienau, who was the head of Refuge Records. And I said, sure. And I met Ray in the Best Western Hotel here in Nashville. We were the Outlaws. I was in the Outlaws now.
Yeah.
And this is 1980. And we met in the hotel after the gig because we were playing a show with Black Sabbath at the arena.
Oh, wow.
And so, I remember Ray came out and James Isaac Elliott, one of his writers and become a lifelong friend of mine, and, you know, dodging a few bottles or whatever was going on. They came out to the show. We went to the hotel. 3 hours later, I had a record deal, a Christian record deal.
Just on your own as a solo artist.
As Rick Kua.
Okay, well, back up a second.
Yeah.
You can't just throw down that you were playing a gig with Black Sabbath and move past that. I got to know what, like, obviously you're in a secular world that is not a Christian world. What was it like being a Christian and being in a band that's not a Christian band, but also like being on the road with some of these legendary acts that, you know, we hear about their exploits and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, here's what it was for me. When we did a Western New York tour in a Western Canada and Western U.S. tour with Black Sabbath. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Mob Rules tour, and we opened for them. And yeah, it was a little crazy until we realized that when we were in the hotel together and it's dinner time, and you know, one of them would come down with his wife and he's got a sport coat on, and they're just regular, normal people doing their theater. That's really, they weren't like what some Christians might have thought. Uh-huh. They were just regular people, and this was theater to them. Now, I will say that I don't know all of their personal stories. Mm-hmm. They may not have been where we felt we were with the Lord, or maybe some of them were and just trying to figure it all out while they made their living.
Yeah.
You know, so it was interesting. We toured with a lot of different bands like that. And I stayed with them for about 3.5 years. And it was, we would call it the big stage. And it was just fun.
Yeah. You know? Oh, I bet. Well, that's every musician's dream,
right?
Is to be on a big tour in front of big audiences, right? And you know, just playing your music and getting that recognition.
Yeah.
But then the transition to the Christian world is a different thing because it's, especially in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say Christian music in its infancy, but I mean, like, it wasn't yet rolling as big as it was going to get maybe in the late 80s, early 90s with the big tours and stuff. So you sign as a solo artist. What happens then? Do you have songs already written? I mean, how did you sign the deal just on your ability alone, or did you already have songs written?
Like, I had a handful of songs. At this point, I had been saved like for 3 years. Uh-huh. And I got all my writing buddies up in New York and my buddies in the Outlaws, whatever. And I knew of the meeting I was going to have with Ray, and I'm thinking, man, I better put something on a cassette if we get to that point.
Yeah.
You know, and I had several songs. One was called You Can Still Rock and Roll. And, you know, you listen to this stuff, and it's very period. That, I think, that record came out in 81. Uh-huh. You know, and that was my first number one. And I had that song and a few more. And I think Ray from the label was, if not more, as interested in my platform with my secular band, The Outlaws, because it was Gold Record Band, and we did a lot and didn't have social media or that in those days, but we were one of the bands, you know. But I played it, and he liked it, and we talked about the contract, and this is March. And I said, well, great. I said, well, yeah, I'll write the rest of the record. And, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to have to write the rest of the record, you know. And I said, well, Ray, when do you want to record this? And he said, well, it's spring now. Let's do it in this early summer. And I'm thinking.
Yeah, like in a couple months?
Yeah, literally. It was like in like maybe 3 months.
So obviously you got to build a team. I mean, you can't just. I mean,
right.
You've got to have some people around you to help you put this thing together. So where did you start?
Yeah, I started with my, before the Outlaws, all the musicians in that Central New York area, they were all my buddies. I had played with most of them one gig or another, whether it was a rock and roll thing or a club or a wedding or a bar mitzvah or whatever it was. Yeah. So I'd gather my musicians that were my guys. I had some couple of bands up there, and the players in that band, we were all best friends. And then some of my Outlaws buddies, they played on the first record with me as well.
Yeah.
So, and the guy, there was one longtime friend of mine, Bob Halligan Jr. Mm-hmm. Bob was from Syracuse, still is. And he had a band called Kaylee Rain, a Celtic rock band, which we can talk about in a minute if you wanted to. Bob and I managed his band called Steak Night in 1974. They went to a university up there, Hamilton, one of the colleges. Mm-hmm. And every Saturday night was steak night. So, of course, they named their band Steak Night. It was the easiest thing to do. Bob is an amazing friend and writer. Everybody from Cyndi Lauper, Judas Priest, Cher, I mean, on and on and on, a hit songwriter. And he and I have wrote most of the stuff that the vast majority of the stuff that I have had recorded over the years. Uh-huh. Of course, there's other guys, Tom Hamby, Dave Perkins, you know, some of my other friends, a number of them. But Bob and I, the Koohahalligan piece was pretty big. You know, I'd get the chorus and the theme and what it is, and we would put our heads together, and he'd do his beautiful thing on it, and we'd, before you know it, we had a great song, and we wound up with 6 number ones out of that.
Wow. And that's a piece that a lot of people don't understand, is that, you know, for us, it was a guy like Dave Clark.
Yeah.
You know, who, you know, you're not going to know his name above Don Cook, probably.
Yeah.
You know, who we were kind of talking about off before we started this. And, yeah. And Don just passed away. We were at his funeral. But Dave was like that little secret ingredient that you call in and make a good song or great song.
Yes, like a song doctor.
A song doctor,
as opposed to just writer, but
right.
He could take whatever it is and polish it
and
up.
And I feel like most artists who have a really successful career have somebody like that around them. Just like directors have, you know, people will come in and rewrite screenplays. And, you know, there's this handful of people that they're just really good at knowing what's missing.
Yes.
And where's that next little push over the cliff for the song and for the listener?
Yeah. And so, I had fortunately several of those great writers. Bob Halligan, again, probably the most with him. Dave Perkins, Robert White Johnson, Tom Hemby, just a number. And I'm probably, if one of you guys are listening right now and I missed you, I'll buy you a nice meal next time you come to town. But
you're going to get a phone call.
I'll tell you. But anyway, I am grateful. And I always wanted to find people that I felt were better than me.
Mm.
Because, you know, that's... Yeah.
That's a secret to success, isn't it?
You surround yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, what's the old thing about the tide raises all boats or something?
Yeah, that's right.
However that saying goes.
Right.
Yeah, so those were good days. And I cherish that.
So, go back to Kaylee Rain. You said there's a story there.
Yeah, well, Bob started a Celtic rock band back in 1994, 1995, 1996. And I was in it and helped him get everything going.
Yeah.
Myself, Tony Hooper, Cactus Mosier. I don't know if you know Cactus.
Another name. Yeah.
He dear friend. And it was we had a bagpipe guy, a tin whistle guy. We had a fiddle. We had a button accordion guy and a severe rock rhythm section. And it was called Kaylee Rain. And he and I, we wrote a handful of songs. One that we wrote that got a lot of attention was called That's All the Lumber. And that got a couple of good cuts with folks.
Uh-huh.
But it was great. We used to play downtown Nashville at Sherlock Holmes Pub on Elliston Place every Thursday night. And it was a ball. So that was a great experience to get to do with that with Bob. Bob has continued on. Obviously, I didn't have the bandwidth to continue to be in that band and do all the other things, but we're still dear friends. And for any of you listening, look up Kaylee Rain. I think you'll love that.
I'm going to listen to it tonight.
Do it. Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like, well, let's go back. You know, you were able to do a lot of really cool things, but let's go back to the genesis of your Christian music career.
Yes. Yes.
And because it had to be, I mean, it had to be a little bit of a culture shift for you and a culture shock to go from the Outlaws and playing in arenas and stadiums with all these big acts to now being on your own, trying to find an audience, trying to find a song for radio.
Yeah.
And how was that for you the first few years?
It was, I knew that's where I was supposed to be. Because I figured, like I bet a lot of us have figured this, if we got 90 minutes with an audience, we want to leave them with something that makes them feel better than when they showed up.
Yeah.
And with the secular bands, it was great. They'd come in all crazy excited, but when the music ended, it's almost like they'd kind of be a little downcast and now the party's over and they just leave, as opposed to you do a Christian show and they're wide-eyed. Even wider than when they came in, maybe, you know? So yeah. I wanted to do that, but it was, the difficult part was, in those days they were picketing rock. It was not unusual to be in, I'll just throw out a state, Texas, and they're out there with picket signs, mm-hmm. walking around the building, or you're doing a rock date. And there's, I remember one night, these two women, lovely sisters, you know, lovely women, and they literally had white long kind of dresses on. I'm not being disrespectful at all, but they came up to me and they said, "Brother, can we talk to you?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." It was in the day where maybe you'd wear a couple sweatshirts and one was cut up a little.
Yeah.
So one was red and the other was black. And they said, "I don't know if you know this, but you've got the devil's colors on."
Oh,
no, I'm serious.
No, I know. I know these stories.
Yeah, I know.
I can tell you a few myself. Yeah.
But I kind of listened, mm-hmm. and I just loved on these women. And I said, "Let me tell you why I'm here." And by the time our little 5-minute conversation mm-hmm. was over, I really believe they got it.
Yeah.
You know, so we'd have a lot of that. Or
even had that at 4M concerts. We had people. Yeah. We had people picketing us. We would have them actually buy tickets to the concert and come just so they could talk to us afterwards. And it was, a lot of the Bill Gothard teaching.
Oh boy.
And that was, you know, where, you know, there's a documentary, I think on Prime that you can watch about the Bill Gothard stuff. But I knew a lot of people that were in that,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you talk about the wearing red and black, well, that's the devil's colors. Mm-hmm. Well, we were told that, you know, if you're playing in 4/4 instead of 3/4, that's the devil always adds something God's design, you know.
Yeah. I had a friend that gave my wife and I tickets for the Bill Gothard conference here in Nashville in the 80s.
Did you go?
Half a night. And then I just very stealthily, we had to leave because of some of the things we were hearing just couldn't abide by, you know.
You know, some of it was... Some of it's very logical. You go through some of that teaching. And again, I have very people that are very close in my life that went through all of that. And I'm like, it's very logical, but there's that, there's, you know, if you're discerning enough, you're going to, something's not right here.
Yeah,
something's a little bit off.
Yeah. You know, the expression, eat the meat, spit out the bones.
Yeah.
Listen, this man, like many, has helped so many people. I would never say a bad word. I'm just saying that for us, there were things where we realized mm-hmm. we maybe weren't going to receive it the way it was intended to be received. So rather than sit there, we just, you know.
I like what you said, that you didn't just, like, you didn't just blow these people off.
Because, never.
You know,
no.
But that, to me, I mean, I'll be honest with you, just in my personality is, I kind of make quick decisions in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of like, you're wrong, I'm right. We're not going to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, but I love the fact that you said you talked with them and heard their side of the story mm-hmm. and you know, loved them through that because they are brothers and sisters
yes.
in Christ. They're just...
They meant well.
Yeah, they did. And they were concerned for you. I mean, that was a thing, is that what I found out about a lot of these people that would come and protest our shows or picket our shows or... You know, would come in and hand us pamphlets afterwards and tell us that, you know, we were, some people told us we were going to hell.
Yeah.
You know, or that we were leading kids to hell.
Yeah.
You know, that they really were trying to do what was right.
They meant well.
They did.
And I could never judge their relationship with the Lord or salvation, any mm-hmm. of that. But honestly, Andy, I'm telling you the truth. That was my favorite part. When somebody was, what I would say, had no understanding of why we were doing what we were doing and the good that it would do in the people that it was meant for, when I could have a minute with them and love them, and I would see a change happen. Now, every now and then, there'd be somebody who's going to stay hard all the way.
Sure.
And I'd love them as well. Because, listen, we're all on this planet together. And God forbid I either mess with God's anointed or make a judgment just out of my own flesh, you know?
I think that's what I really admired about guys like you, Rick, that I didn't have the experience of, was you came from the secular world into the Christian world.
Mm-hmm.
You, you saw the difference in where you wanted to go and what you felt like God was calling mm-hmm. you to do. I was, for lack of a better term, I was born into it. You know,
yeah.
I was born into a Christian home. I got yeah. saved as a kid.
Yeah.
I sang the hymns in church and yeah. then I discovered Christian music and I'm going to go do that.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a night and day choice for me. It was kind of a gradual thing of like, then I'm going to do this and this mm-hmm. and this. And, you know, to me, if I'm just honest, guys like you kind of intimidated me.
Oh.
In a way, just because I'm like, not only the skill set, but just the fact that you had lived a lot more life than I had in that regard, and you had chosen this. Mm. Does that make sense?
No, I hear you.
And I want to segue that thought into your music and your career, because you chose a path, or, you know, your skill set and the way you wrote and the way you performed in the long haul, didn't quite fit into mainstream
right.
Christian music. And so I've had a lot of artists on here that was their, I mean, in an extreme way, the 77s.
Yeah.
I had Michael Rowe on to talk about their career and couldn't be farther from the center of Christian music
yeah.
in the day, but made fantastic music.
Yeah.
Fantastic music and influenced so many other artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to be talked about, you know, in the foundation
yes.
of what we call the glory days of CCM.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the way I see you, Rick, and your band and what you wrote. So walk us through just a little bit how your career unfolded in the scope of where Christian music was going.
Yeah, well, you know, for a while there, you made a gesture with your hand earlier of the going up the hill. Now you're yeah. on the top of the hill and then you're on the other side. Uh-huh. So during we hung in there because we saw kids getting saved every night.
Wow.
And we touched people, and we were the first guys in the building and the last ones out. If there was one person left, I was not leaving until I got to love on them and talk to them. So that part, the picketing and all the other stuff that was a little disheartening, we got to the point where, hey, so what? I mean, we know we're touching. If it's just one, we were okay with it. Yeah, we wanted a room full, of course.
Yeah.
We wanted everybody loving it, but we knew we were doing God's work.
So you had an evangelist spirit.
Oh, it was
every
night, altar call, always.
Oh, I love that.
And we made sure that there was going to be follow-up for the kids, mm-hmm. and, you know, because it was a big deal, that was really why we were there. Yes, we hope we could sell some CDs and put gas in the truck,
yeah.
you know, but,
yeah.
but not only that, and have that, they let them carry God's message away with them on that CD or on the t-shirt, what was written on the t-shirt, like yeah. we all did, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so there was that part. And then it got to where Christian rock was it was more accepted. And mm-hmm. For me, there was a number of songs that I think would be more edgy. You know, of course, in those days, Willie George Ministries, I don't know if you remember Willie George.
Okay, hang on a second. So Willie George hired me in 2005 to be his worship pastor at Church on the Move.
Really?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean,
so you know them well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
so they did. And for all you musicians out there that are trying to, you know, mortgage the house to do a music video, let me just make you a little envious. In those days, we went to do the Willie George Fire by Night show.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And we did it five times. And every time we went, they would fly us in and we'd do the show. And we do a music video for free. And so all my videos were done with Willie George.
Wow. Stephen Yake?
Stephen Yake,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this was in the beginning of those days for him where
right.
he was on staff there.
Uh-huh.
And I Can, I Will, that song
yeah.
and that video that wound up being a rock song of the year in, I think, 89, stayed number one for six
yeah,
weeks.
Yeah, and that's the song that I most, when I hear your name, I start singing, I Can,
yeah,
I Will. And I remember
funny.
The video. I mean, it was so iconic.
It was fun, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
where was that show? Was that shot in Tulsa?
In Tulsa.
It was in a warehouse.
Yes, and I wonder, we did another video in Tulsa in Broken Arrow.
Yeah.
at the high school. It was called Young Boy, Young Girl.
Oh, well, yeah, I remember that.
Not to be confused with one young man who came up saying, can you play that song, Oh Boy, Young Girl? So not to be confused with that, but we shot it like a prom night thing.
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
video, they did a good job.
Wow.
And they did Don't Say Suicide, which we did in a cemetery outside of Tulsa.
Okay.
And that's when some Christians showed up. They were going to witness to us and get us saved because we're a rock band playing in a cemetery. They must have hung out in cemeteries or something, but anyway.
Yeah, we did a video in a cemetery, never got picketed. I feel kind of cheated now.
I know.
Yeah. Wow, you got all the fun stuff.
That's funny.
That's incredible. Yeah, so many people, you know, it's amazing as I have these conversations, there are certain touch points, you know, that we can all kind of like, we all recognize, or we all have some sort of connection back yeah. to, and Fire by Night
yeah.
is one of those. Of course,
I loved what they did.
Oh, yeah.
Family First on there. Uh-huh. You know, they'd make this VCR
yeah.
Once a month and cycle it out to all the youth yep. groups. It was well done.
Yeah, well, Willie didn't do anything second class.
I mean, bet not.
Whatever he did was going to be the best.
Yeah.
And he's still like that today.
Yeah.
He has a ranch out in north of Tulsa, where he brings out pastors and ministers to them. And, but I mean, it's first class all the way.
God
it's just,
bless him,
you know,
man.
He's one of the most wonderful men
yep.
that I've ever had in my life.
And, I love
and
that.
I think the world of him.
Now, how about That's Blaine really Bartel? Cool. Did you know Blaine?
I know Blaine very well.
Yep. Blaine was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, Blaine's
when we
got
were
a
there.
Great story. I don't know if you know it, but I would recommend his book, Death by a Thousand Lies, I think.
Oh.
He went through some.
Some stuff.
He went through some stuff,
oh.
and he's doing really, really great.
I'm glad.
But
what a nice guy. Yeah. I always love Blaine.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. So yeah, Blaine and Yake, and of course Carmen was a big part of that.
Yep.
For a long time.
Yep.
And
yep.
And just it seemed like so many bands went through there early in their career.
Yeah.
And it gave them a great platform.
It was a gift to us.
Yeah, that's great.
But those guys, there would be a big chunk out of my legacy in mm-hmm. those years if it wasn't for them.
Yeah.
Steve Yake just poured his heart into those videos
mm.
and they spoke to people.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the best at that. Mm. And, you know, okay. So being a rocker and Christian, would you call yourself, I mean, is that okay to call
yeah.
you a rocker?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up playing a lot of jazz and bebop and all yeah. of that fusion and all that. But you realize that if you're going to make a living in secular music, a good one,
yeah.
you're going to play rock and roll.
Right.
You know, and I was an East Coast rock guy anyway, yeah. being from New York.
So. I'm sure you could play all the hits, all the standards from every band. I mean, you had to be.
Oh, in the club days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then we yeah. started writing our own things. I got an interesting story about that, but whenever you might want to.
No, go for it. That's why we're here.
So I had a band back in the early days before I was saved. And even after I was saved, the band was called, this is before the drug. It was CRACK, CRAC, which was okay. it was an acronym, Kua, yeah. Rosano, Arlotta, and Chisholm. And so this is 45 years ago, whatever, 40, uh-huh. 45 years ago. A couple of years ago, I get a phone call, and there's a record label in the UK called King Underground, and they discovered the one and only R&B record that we released.
Oh, it's R&B.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was R&B, and uh-huh. it was we had a couple of R&B type singers, and it was a great rhythm section. Again, we all grew up together. We're great friends, and we made this record called All for You. They discovered it, and they made a vinyl re-release of it 45 years later.
How cool!
And even in subsequently. Licensed it in Japan. They did a single in Japan. All this crazy stuff's coming. Two of the guys are in heaven. We're all on Social Security at this point.
And you could have never guessed that
Medicare.
Would happen.
And then Record Store Day, which is a thing in the yeah. UK once a year.
Yeah.
They did a silver vinyl special edition. And me and my old buddies, I mean, I'm 75 at this point, and we keep looking at each other saying, we couldn't get arrested when we had the energy to actually play, you know.
Man, that just, you know, it's the old adage, if you do something well, people will find it.
Yeah.
If you're good at something, you put your heart into it. And it's just, man, sometimes some flowers take a long time to bloom.
Yeah. And we never know what God's going to do.
That's right.
And so you do it.
That's a great
testimony.
Because
you love it. But who knows?
Yeah.
You know? So that was fun. That was a little fun.
How crazy is that? Well, tell me, I want to know who you used to tour with. Like, who were your buddies that you hung out with in your heyday of touring and being out on the road? And
of course, Black Sabbath, people we did dates with, the Tubes. We toured with ZZ Top.
Yeah.
Before the plane crash and before I joined Outlaws, they were out with Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Skynyrd, yeah.
And we did Molly Hatchet.
Wow.
Marshall Tucker. Blackfoot, Allman Brothers, Rod Stewart. I mean, there's Joan Jett. There was a lot.
Wow.
It's hard to pull all the names out. Mm-hmm. But whether it was a tour or a festival or one-off thing, you know.
Yeah. That had to make you better musician, too.
Oh, it was great.
Not just to be around them, but feel like you've got to hold your own. And
yeah.
You don't want to embarrass yourself. I've felt that way.
Oh, of course.
Being around just really great vocalists and you know that I'm just kind of in awe of, going, I better have my stuff together.
I know,
before I get up on that stage.
And when you got up on that stage and your stuff was together,
yeah,
you knew it.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
I mean,
oh, you
and,
did.
And
yeah,
you're
you
thinking,
did.
And not, and you're, it's not, none of us are the best. Let's say that.
No,
but we are on par with the best of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, now listen, there's guys I admire that I wish I could play bass like some of these guys, and I just admire them, and I'm not bummed out that I can't do that, because I do what I do.
Yeah.
And I'm good with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was that bit of, you wanted to do your very best, because you figure if you're in line with some of those people, and you're there for a reason, then you're going to give everything you got.
That's right.
You know.
Well, I always compare, especially when I'm coaching and teaching music, I compare music to food. Like, I feel like it's a really good parallel that everybody has a taste, but there's things that transcend taste.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're like, I'm not really a mushroom guy, but if a mushroom's prepared like that and you know, it's like the best in the world, of course I'm going to try it. I respect it. And that's the thing too, is you don't want to be the one dish on the buffet that everybody's like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Everything
yeah.
else is amazing. You don't yeah. want to be that one thing that nobody goes
right.
back for seconds for, right?
Right.
And there comes a point too, you know this, that, you know, you said you know you're good.
Yeah.
Like, you know you belong up there. Is after a certain point, if you're not being, you know, asked to leave, if you're continuing to get opportunities, then you do, that confidence does grow. And then when the confidence grows, it forces you or it makes you want to get better. It makes you want to explore. Now, what's the next thing and the next thing? Because you do start to see this gift kind of is endless if I really want to go after it.
Yeah. And God made us that way. And I want to just, I'm grateful for so many, for everything, for the most simple things. Now and then my wife, Diana, will be married this month, 6 days. 54 years.
Wow, congratulations.
And she'll look at me
when I'm
grateful for some little whatever, and she just looks, gives me that look. And I'm thinking, no, honey, I'm serious. I'm grateful for all of it. You know, but you just, because of whatever God gives us, we want to honor him by doing the best we can with that.
That's
being
right.
diligent. But knowing who we are and where our limits are. If anybody wants to know, the great bass players, just ask me, because I mean, they're all, I look at them and wish I think in my head I can play what they do, but I can't. But you know, we do what we're built to do. As you know, the Army slogan is the best.
Yeah.
Be all that you can be. I love that, because that's what
right.
I've always wanted to do before the Lord. God, you've made me for a reason. I've got my little slice of all of this stuff. Let me be real good at it.
Yeah. Well, and you were and are.
Well,
and,
thank you.
You know, again, I'm a fan.
Thank you.
So it was just, it was a thrill for you to reply back that you would come and do this with me. I'm going to put you on the spot. Since you talk about bass players that you admire,
yeah.
I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Give me your top five bass
okay.
players.
Okay. Stanley Clarke, Jaco Pastorius, Eddie Gomez.
Who is that? I don't know Eddie.
Upright bass player. Ray Brown.
Okay.
Upright bass player. And I'm just going to throw in a local buddy of mine, Gary Lunn.
Oh my gosh. Talk about a legend in Gary Christian music in Nashville.
Gary is a dear friend, and he is just awesome.
Wow.
I love him.
He has played on, I don't know that we've ever done, we ever did a record, even back in our Truth days, that Gary didn't play on.
Mm-hmm.
He just goes all the way back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're That's crazy. Funny. Anytime I ask, even for me, if somebody says your top five vocalists, I can just spit out my top four. That fifth's always the one that I go, I'm just going to, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you kind of look at, hey, you know what? This guy.
Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, I remember years ago, Bass Player Magazine did an article on some of us Nashville guys. I think there was four or five of us. It was me. It was Gary Lunn, I believe. But it was five of us. And I was so happy to see the hardworking Nashville musicians, bass players, get a little ink in that magazine. Wow. And I always want to recognize my buddies. You know, I'll recognize the what I would call the guys that maybe I've never met, but I've listened and loved. Pino Palladino's another one.
Yeah.
Just listened and loved to, loved what they did. But I celebrate my pals because they're professional musicians and they're great.
Yeah.
And they got great hearts, you know? And it's nice when the people you admire are for you as much as you are for them.
We all kind of, at some point, we figure out our place, don't we?
Yeah.
It takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're ambitious, and you know, sometimes if we feel like the sky's the limit, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah,
we can. I'm done with that, and I want to go do that. But at some point, don't you feel like we kind of settle in and go, "This is what God created me to do, and I did it, and
yes.
and I'm happy with that."
Yeah, I'm the same way. And the idea, Andy, of legacy has been a big thing. When I turned 70 and I started getting into those years, I thought, what can I've got all these records and different things, and praise God for that. And that's going to outlive me, you know, and as long as people can still know how to play a CD anyway. And then I said, what else can I do? And that's why I wrote a book, you know, What Are You Known For? Building Your Legacy One Brick at a Time.
Is that for me?
Oh yeah. I brought them in for you.
I can't wait to read it.
And along with a little companion, 31-day devotional. So I I've got a couple other things in mind that to me would be part of something I can leave behind.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say to you or anybody listening, you know, in a lifetime, God's going to show all of us a bunch of stuff. And if it's only for our family, but it will be for more than that.
Yeah.
But if it was only for our family, once we close our eyes and go to heaven, unless they know every ounce of history and every bit of wisdom God dropped in our hearts, that's going to be gone.
Yeah.
You know, so I just encourage people, leave something.
I love that.
Along the way.
I love that. Well, and obviously you're going to leave your music.
Oh, yeah.
And what a precious gift that is. That's one thing I think about is, you know, my kids and grandkids are going to have a discography. They're going to have a playlist of my voice, and we sing our testimonies, don't we?
We do.
We sing about what's going on in our lives and what God's doing through us. That's the beauty of Christian music, I think, as opposed to secular music, which, I mean, is an obvious comparison, but what's even, I think, more of a blessing to our families than the generations that follow is they know who we were.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they can hear it. Mm-hmm. They can hear it in our voices. They can hear it in the music that we wrote and were a part of. And again, going back to Don Cook, who passed away just a few weeks ago, as we're recording this, and we were just at his funeral, Dave Clarke got up and said, you know, one of the last things that Don told him before he passed was, I wish I could leave something more for my family.
Mm.
And Dave said, look at the gift you've already given with all these songs that you've written. They have a window into your soul that most people are not going to have of their father or grandfather. And I do think it's a real gift for us, no matter what path our career took, even if we just did one record, you know. But you know, for us, we have a body of work that we can share with the generations that follow. They get to see us, you know, living out the dreams that God put in our heart.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's and again, yeah, we can share it with the world, but you're right. It's a real gift for our families.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thing. Our lives go on, but if it stopped right now, we've had a real good life.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. If you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.